A legal education means you will learn to speak in a new language. You will be taught to achieve insight into the world around you and to sharply question what you know.
You can't handle the truth!
You're out of order! You're out of order! The whole trial is out of order!
What are you doing, detective? What are you doing talking to my client without me present? You sneaky Pete!
Lose! I don't lose! I win! I win! I'm a lawyer! That's my job! That's what I do!
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Comedians at Law podcast, episode 65. I'm your host, Matt Ritter, and with me, as always, is Alex Barnett.
Hey, guys. How's everybody doing?
It's end of the year, man. It's the end of 2013 for Comedians at Law.
It is, but with every end, there's a new beginning, so we're excited about that.
That's right. It's a wonderful time to be a comedian at holiday parties where everybody's drunk.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Do you find that when you do holiday parties, people are in a better mood than in normal shows?
Yes, absolutely. Because, it's just that time of year. People are excited. They're getting their bonuses. They're getting drunk. They're festive. They're watching the Rudolph specials on television.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's a Wonderful Life.
Maybe, exactly. You know? Exactly.
So what do we have coming up? You've got a big show for the Augusta Bar?
Yeah. Well, so, we have the couple of holiday parties you talked about, and then coming into January, we're starting the year off strong. We've got the Augusta Bar Association event that I'm going to be doing. And then you and Kevin will be down at Vanderbilt Law School. And then you'll be in Arizona for a couple of shows with a group from there.
Yeah, we're actually really excited. We've got a couple of good guests. We may have the dean of one of the Arizona law schools, and we have a local area lawyer who might be jumping on the bill. So it's always nice to get some local flavor too.
That's great. That's great. So yeah, if you're interested in having us perform, reach out now because our calendar's getting booked up quickly.
Yeah, we're pretty much almost already fully booked for January and most of February, which is, exciting.
Yeah.
So should we jump into these news stories? We got some good ones.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's get into it right away.
Since when has the paragon of investigative journalism allowed lawyers to determine the news content?
So, this one's hot off the presses. Really hot off the presses. There is a PR exec named Justine Sacco. Very attractive, by the way. I think that plays into this story. For me, at least. She's super, super hot. She's quite the Twitterer.
Not anymore.
Not anymore. She's not. Yeah, she wrote a racist tweet on her way to Africa. She wrote, "Going to Africa. Hope I don't get AIDS. Just kidding. I'm white."
Right. And then she turned off her phone and got on the plane.
Yeah, you think to yourself, okay, if I'm not going to have any opportunity as a PR exec to do spin control for 13 hours, what's the last thing I want to say?
Right. So the best part is she gets on the plane, turns off her phone while she's flying to Africa, to South Africa, where her family is from. Yeah. The post was retweeted over 3,000 times.
That's a lot. It's a lot of times.
That's better than any tweet I've ever done.
And she was pretty big time. I mean, she's a PR exec for Barry Diller's IAC, and she repped Vimeo, OkCupid, and Tinder.
Yeah.
I wonder if she had a profile on Tinder. So we should find out if anybody hit her up on one of the social media. So the question of the day, I guess, is, look, this ties right into, the Duck Dynasty stuff. Are people just not aware that, Twitter is—it's not just like some little inside joke with your friends.
Yeah, well, I think it goes to the immediacy of social media and the fact that it's removed mostly the filters between people's brains and publication.
It's also removed any context.
Well, that's true too, but I mean, it'd be hard to figure out a context in which this would be appropriate.
Well,
it
wouldn't be, but we know nothing about this person other than this tweet. We're judging her solely on this one racist tweet.
Right, but I think, especially as a PR executive, you'd have to be smart enough to know. That's worked true. As a PR executive, so don't you think that she knew full well that that people will be judged by their Twitter and Facebook posts?
Oh, so yeah, if anybody should not be sending out these kind of tweets, it's this woman. I mean, this is like. it's almost too obvious, you know, which is amazing to me. But you look, I mean, you know, you see it all the time from athletes and entertainers. You rarely see it from a PR exec, but you see this unfiltered mentality, like, oh, I have a voice, I can say anything I want, and it's funny. It's just amazing to me that there wasn't a policy in place to just not allow people to do things like this at these companies.
Yeah, no, it is interesting. Now, what's interesting too is, you know, look, she was fired immediately, it sounds like. The question is, was being fired an appropriate punishment, or was it an overreaction? In other words,
well, that's what I'm saying.
I'm not saying. I'm not justifying.
Without context, you can't say I know nothing. We know nothing about people, and we go, okay, well, she got fired. She deserved it. I don't know. I don't know if she did or didn't. I know that tweet was ridiculously offensive and stupid.
Right, and I'm not defending it. All I'm saying is I don't know whether that's a firing offense or whether there was some other punishment that could have been put in place by the company that would have been less permanent.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because what is the goal of the firing? You know, I mean, just to distance yourself as a company from that tweet, you know?
Well, in this case, probably yes, but you know, it doesn't really solve the problem. I mean, she's removed from the equation, but now she's going to spend the rest of her life probably explain. Now, what's ironic about it is that she's going to probably wind up getting a book deal out of this because she's going to write a book about the Twitter, you know, the tweet she sent and how that led to this whole other life for herself.
Maybe she'll get hired on to Duck Dynasty. I don't know.
Something like that. You know, it's like it's so weird how our world has become. You know, someone does something that's really like across the line or even illegal, and then they get a book deal, and then they become famous and rich.
Well, but I mean, the other thing about this is, right, like, yeah, you know, a year ago or 2 years ago, this just wouldn't have been anything, you know?
I don't know. Maybe I think it still would have been, but certainly things have picked up velocity.
They really have. I mean, I'm just saying, you know, look, we're kind of lucky in the sense that we're comedians and we sort of have a higher threshold. Who's holding us accountable for our stupid and offensive tweets?
Well, but people are. I mean, I think Steve Martin just had gotten into some hot water for a tweet. And
do we think that's good? I mean, do we want comedians to be held accountable for their, you know?
Well, you know, the gut reaction is no, you don't. But on the other hand, Twitter is not, you know, being on stage. It's somebody's personal thoughts, theoretically.
Well, talk to Rob Delaney about that. He built a comedy career off of it.
Yeah. So, I mean, the question is, you know, on your Twitter account, should you have license to just be offensive? And I guess the answer is, at some level, if you live in America, you have that license because you have freedom of speech.
Yeah.
But I guess freedom of speech also means freedom of consequences. I mean, if you choose to be offensive, people can act accordingly.
Yeah. I mean, I also think, you know, it's on. I think in some ways it's going to have to be on the employers. You know, you're seeing just so much of this. At some point, you know, we have like HR seminars. Like, put this in the damn HR seminar.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I think that's right. So, well, we'll see what happens. My guess is she's going to have a book deal within a year.
My guess is Twitter is going to become a lot more boring in the next year.
Oh, I think not. I think it's going to you put your finger on it. I think it's going to be even more offensive stuff.
Well, because yes. I actually think we're in the glory days of athletes writing offensive things, and I think those are going to end soon. I think teams are going to cut down on them being able to do that.
Yeah, but there's always stupid young people.
Yeah.
You know, who keep growing up in the age of Instagram and selfies and everything else.
She also said she wanted to have sex with an autistic child. I'm not really sure like where she was even going with the humor there. Like, I don't get why that would be funny.
I don't know, but this sounds like a woman who maybe needed a significant time out.
Yeah, I mean, here's the real problem is she's so attractive that she's been getting away with unfunny things, passing them off as funny because guys are like, "Oh, you're so funny."
Yeah.
You know?
Well, what's ironic is she only had 231 followers, so she exploded her Twitter account overnight, and she'll never get to reap the benefit of it.
This is just a case of an attractive girl getting having people say yes to everything she's ever done in life. That's what I think.
Yeah, that's possible.
Anyway, let's move on from this clown, this muppet.
Okay. Well, this story is right up your alley, this next one, out of Canada.
It's right up my alley. my favorite country in the world has always been Canada. You know that, right? I mean, you know,
I do know that. I
always talk about it. Basically, what happened is a female justice of the court up there has overturned a prostitution ban and made a lot of the prostitution laws illegal. Her basic rationale was that the laws are overreaching and they actually don't serve a valid function. All they do is make it more dangerous for these workers to engage in their sex practice.
Right. And I think, well, I know that you're ecstatic about this ruling because...
I already booked a two-week vacation to Canada.
Right.
With my girlfriend, we're going together on a romantic trip to Canada.
Right, romantic, in air quotes. I think, look, this goes to the very heart of the prostitution debate, right? The debate always is that prostitution is something that is totally anti-feminist and that it's imposed upon women. No woman would choose to be a prostitute, and it's inherently dangerous and bad for women. And the other argument is, well, some women do engage in this voluntarily, but regardless, since prostitution has existed since the dawn of man, we should make it as safe as possible for the people who engage in it.
Prostitutes ain't going anywhere.
Well, I think that is a truism that maybe people need to think about. But
I think these people should be protected. You know, I mean,
That's right.
It's already not the best job in the world. Let's put it that way. It shouldn't be, dangerous.
Right. I mean, look, let me be clear. So just in case anyone's listening, I mean, neither Matt nor I nor the Comedians of Law nor anybody I know is advocating for sex trafficking or slavery or making women be prostitutes against their will. What we're saying is that this judge is going at this the correct way, which is if there's going to be prostitution, you should allow the prostitutes to take actions that protect themselves, their safety and health, and the state should provide basic health and safety measures.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like the condom law, you know, in the porn industry.
That's right, or the way they used to have needle exchange, I think, in Switzerland for drug users.
I mean, look, you know, a lot of Europe already acknowledges these things with drugs. You know, it's very similar to drugs, too. I mean, if you think about the drug wars, you know, I mean, there's this argument about marijuana use, let's regulate it, let's this. Let's accept the realities of society as it is.
Right. And that's the age old debate. You know, do you accept the world as it is, or do you fight against that? And I think
I agree with you in the sense that prostitution is different because it seems that there is a victim in some senses.
Well, certainly in certain instances there is, but at the same time, I think even in those instances, not that you want to defend those practices, but the prostitute should always have access to basic health and safety measures, whether it's STD testing or condoms or police protection in the case that they're being beaten by somebody. I mean, like, you know, those are the types of things that the state should be providing as a basic human rights.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I just checked kayak.com. The prices have skyrocketed for flights.
Well, I like as an aside. I mean, obviously, Canada's ecstatic about this because until now, I mean, like photo moose safaris, I think was definitely trailing off as a tourist attraction.
That was the raciest stuff. That was the raciest stuff you would do was go
right,
moose hunting. Anyway, so good for Canada. Bravo to them. Which kind of segues into our next story. Which is right as we're patting them on the back, we are chastising a school there. I don't even know if you want to call this a school. You know, do you call unaccredited law schools law schools?
I would call them a gathering place.
I wouldn't call it a gathering place for learning either.
No, I would call it like a community center or a gathering place.
It's like a YMCA that they charge you a lot of money for,
and there are books.
And there are books. Yeah, it's basically like a weird library.
Right,
it's a weird library. So, you know, it's a religious school, and as part of their, you know, community guidelines, they have basically tried to ban any homosexual activity and sin, you know, just the same nonsense that Phil Robertson from the Duck Dynasty clan was spewing, essentially, but that's in their code of conduct.
Right, which is, okay, so there you go. So all these people are going to hold hands and go off into a corner and ignore the fact that homosexuals exist, I guess.
Yeah, in the legal profession, there's a lot of lawyers that are, you know, gay and lesbian, and it's just, why would they want to, first of all, I don't know, who wants to go to these unaccredited, just nonsensical schools anyway, you know? You're better off not being around these people.
Right. Well, the discussion we were having off air before this was that, in fact, if they wanted to do a public service for Canada, what they should have done is open a school for Canadian cuisine, right?
That's right.
And that was what we talked
Poutine.
That's right, because Canada, as everyone knows, as great as they are, our neighbors to the north have like unrecognized cuisine. Like, yeah. They don't make, what do they make? Canadian bacon and beer. That's it.
Yeah, they are not. They don't really have anything. We looked it up. You know, we did look it up. It was poutine, and you know, there was some jerky, some sort of jerkies. That's
like salmon jerky, I think it was. So I think these guys are wasting dollars. They should have opened a school of Canadian school of cooking. But in the absence of that, I think you're right that this gathering place where they can sit around and talk about how they all hate homosexuals is I don't know. I think it's sort of a non-starter in a legal profession.
Yeah, it should be a non-starter. I mean, I don't know how you get to that point, right? You're like, oh, we're going to open a law school, and the first thing we're going to do is make sure that we, you know, make up some ridiculous laws against, you know, civil rights.
Right, and I guess that would be their hope to get accredited, was to engage in this, like, anti-civil rights practices.
Yeah, it's absurd, and thankfully, you know, Canada's Council on Law Schools issued a statement against this practice, against this, you know, community guidelines.
Yeah.
It's total nonsense. And look, there's bad eggs in Canada too, I guess.
Yes.
You know?
Our neighbors
to the north have some crazies as well.
Yes. Yes.
Anyway, so that, I think that wraps up our news stories for the week.
Yeah.
Next up, we have our Kevin's little segment, Kevin's Corner. Let's hear him talk about an interesting topic on the internet this week.
Thanks, Matt and Alex. This is Kevin Israel with another installment of Kevin versus the Internet. I like to use this time to talk about a story that really gets to me. And we have a big one this week, Duck Dynasty. I'm sure we've all heard about it. Phil Robertson of the Duck Dynasty clan made some comments in a GQ interview. Some were anti-homosexual. He made some racist comments. And he said basically what you would think a guy from the backwoods with a giant beard who spends his life hunting ducks would say. That it was horrible, it was hateful, it was ignorant, but I don't think any of us were surprised that he said it. Now, the fallout of this, he's been suspended from Duck Dynasty. Duck Dynasty might be taken off the air, and A&E is in damage control mode, trying to save face. A lot of the arguments online and in the media are First Amendment issues. He should be able to say whatever he wants. You know, if the statements weren't that bad, we can argue that till we're blue in the face. Anybody who spent time in law school, First Amendment arguments are circular. They just go round and round and nobody gets anywhere. The fact is, in my opinion, what he said is stupid. It was ignorant. And yeah, we can make fun of the guy for being a redneck. But the real issue is, should he be allowed to say what he said? And does A&E have a right to suspend him? And my opinion is, no, A&E actually shouldn't suspend him. And here's why. You've made millions of dollars off of a show that features these kind of characters. You love showing them in their natural habitat, being nutcases. They're hunters who have made millions of dollars off of selling, I think, one of the world's most popular duck calls. Well, you know what? This is an assumption of risk issue. You knew what they're capable of. You put them out into the public, and, you know, they're going to say stuff. They're going to say crazy shit. You made money off of the crazy shit they say on the air. Well, now you have to deal with what they say in the media. So for you to say, well, we want you to be real on air, but don't be so real when you're getting interviewed, well, that's just ridiculous. If you want to be a reality show network, well, that's what you get to deal with. If you don't want to have these possible situations, then all of your shows should be very family-friendly, you know, church shows. But if you want to walk the edge and you want to be a little more risky, well, this is the risk you run, and you get to deal with it. So you've made the millions, but now you get to pay the price because these guys are going to go and do interviews. That's my opinion. That's just where I stand on it. Let me know what you think. I'd love to hear from some of you guys, the Comedians of Law listeners. So you can tweet at me at KevinIsrael_NJ, or you can tweet at Comedians at Law at Comedians at Law with the hashtag CalPod, and let me know what you think. I'm sure there's a lot of law school students out there who are embroiled in constitutional law and have an opinion on this, and I definitely want to hear from you. So that's it for me, Kevin Israel, and Kevin versus the Internet. Back to you, Alex and Matt.
Good stuff from Kevin. I really enjoyed talking about the Duck Dynasty. You know, I wanted to get to that. I'm glad somebody did.
Yeah, absolutely. So Kevin versus
the
Internet.
You and I were talking, though, didn't we? You wanted to make a bet about that, right? I actually think he's not going to get fired.
Right. I think my point was I think they'll finish filming, or they'll finish showing the episodes that have been shot already, and then I think the show is over.
Yeah, offline we were talking, and we said as a terms of the bet, if I win and the show continues and gets another season, Alex will grow his beard, you know, Duck Dynasty levels.
I will grow a Duck Dynasty ZZ Top beard.
And if the show does not continue and Alex wins, I can't really grow a beard, so I will have to fashion one. Is that what we said? Yeah.
Fake, right out of the feathers of ducks.
Yeah. I'll use my down comforter.
Right.
All right, so next up, we actually have a great interview. You want to set that up for us?
Yeah, this is a great interview for us because we interview people of note in the legal community who have something funny or interesting about their job. This, in this particular instance, John Avi Goldstein was able to interview Paul D'Angelo, who is a lawyer turned comedian.
Hey, we know something about that.
Yeah, so he's out of New England. He's been around for years. He's a big headliner out of New England, and so it was great to have him on the show. So let's turn to that interview right now.
Welcome to the Comedians at Law podcast. I'm Genevieve Goldstein, and I am here today with Paul D'Angelo, who is an attorney turned professional comedian. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, Genevieve. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Oh, fine, thanks.
And you're in Boston, right?
I am in Boston, Massachusetts, freezing my butt off right now.
Has there been snow there yet?
Just a little bit, but...
Just a little bit. Well, I'm a wimp. It's been like 50 degrees in California, and I'm freezing my butt off.
I lived there for 6 years in Hollywood, and I got bored because it was nice every day.
Right. You need the bad to remind you just how good it is. So, Paul, you were an attorney for a very long time. I know that you were a district attorney. Is that correct?
Assistant district attorney for 11 years. I supervised several... district court and then jury sessions. In fact, the last couple of years that I was working as an assistant DA, I was supervising the busiest volume jury session in Massachusetts.
Wow. And then you did some private criminal practice on the defense side?
I was a criminal defense attorney for about 4 years, and I was very successful with that. But I kind of had a tough time sometimes looking at myself in the mirror because I was getting a lot of people off, and I'd look at myself and go, I don't know if I'm doing the world a favor here.
And how long have you been doing comedy?
I started doing comedy while I was still in the DA's office, so I'd say about 23 or 4 years now.
Wow, great. And for those of you listening, you can check out Paul's schedule, his work, his biography, everything at his website, which is www.pdangelo.com. That's pdangelo.com. So make sure to visit that. And just so I can boast a little bit about you, I know you've done the Montreal Just for Laughs Festival. You've been on Showtime, and you've toured all over.
Yeah, I've been very lucky. We had a movie on Showtime called The Godfathers of Comedy that I did with some other Italian-American comedians who are all friends of mine, by the way. It was the highest rated, highest reviews or whatever, I forget how they put it, on Showtime to that date for a comedy special. Yeah. And I've got to open for some great people like Aretha Franklin, Ray Charles, the Beach Boys, Chicago, Tom Jones, people like that, probably over 60 international acts like that.
Fantastic. Now, not your favorite comedian, but who's and it's probably hard to pick a favorite, of well-known comedians that you've performed with, who's been your favorite to work with, or few favorites?
My favorite to work with? You know what? That's a good question. I've got to perform with Jay Leno when I lived out in California. I've got to perform... on the same, I got to do a few shows with Dennis Miller,
mm-hmm.
With Joan Rivers, with George Carlin before he died, because, you know, a lot of people, they asked me to describe my comedy, and I've heard more people describe me as George Carlin-ish, so.
That's a great compliment.
Yeah, so that was a thrill to do that, George is not so much a set up punchline guy, but more of a storyteller,
mm-hmm.
And also has some kind of meaning to his act. Not everything that I do has a meaning, and I don't get preachy, but hidden in there, I think I talk about a lot about, just things that are going on and values and things like that. And I kind of sell it so that it doesn't get preachy.
Right, right. That's great. Now, a question for you. Did you always want to be a comedian? Did you fall into it like many of us do? And when you were working for the government as a prosecutor, how did they take it when you started doing comedy?
Okay. Let's see. That's a compound question. Let me see.
There's the lawyer in you calling me out on objection.
I had no intention. No intention of. I had never performed on stage in any way. I was a funny guy with my friends, and I think a lot of people are like that. But to be able to do the same thing in front of a bunch of strangers, 300, 400. 2,000, 3,000 strangers is a whole different thing. So it doesn't always translate. So I was funny with my friends and everything, and I had no intention of doing that. But when I was an assistant DA, I started going to watch live comedy. I was always a fan of comedy as a kid. My dad would wake me up, who was a very funny man, by the way. My biggest influence is my father and my uncle, my Irish father and my Italian uncle, who... were both just very funny men. My father, a great joke teller. My uncle, a great storyteller. And my father would wake me up to watch the comedians on the Ed Sullivan Show when I was a little boy. And I stole my uncle's Bill Cosby albums and listened to them over and over again. And that was a big influence on me. But I had never done anything in public. I started going to watch live comedy, but never with the intention of doing it myself until I performed at my friend's bachelor party. If you call it a performance, they asked us all to roast him, and everybody was waiting for my presentation, and I was pretty drunk, to be honest with you, and I talked for about 45 minutes, and it went over so well, and everybody kept coming up to me and saying, hey, we want to hire you, and I said, no, this is a one-time thing. But I started going back to the comedy clubs, and instead of being just a spectator, I said, I was kind of looking at it analytically and saying, you know, can I do this? Mm-hmm. I think I'm funnier than this guy. And what happened was I was a very successful attorney. I was a good attorney. I knew I couldn't go through that customary period that you suck at the beginning of being a comedian. So right. I said, I have to be good right away. So I wasn't worried about the presentation. I'd probably done 100 trials up to that point. But what I did is I said, I'm going to have 20, 25 minutes of material before I do my first 5-minute open mic night.
Wow.
I did it. I loved it so much, they had to physically take me off the stage. They had to come up and take me by the arm to get me off the stage.
So you did not respect the light on your first
No, I loved it. I didn't want to get off of there. It went over very well. It probably only did about a dozen open mics, and then my family got on my back and said, what are you doing? What's wrong with you? You're a good attorney. You've got to concentrate on being an attorney. So I quit, but I kept writing.
Mm-hmm.
And 7-8 months later, I was ready to take a job. I narrowed it down to a couple law firms that offered me jobs, and at the last minute, I panicked, and I called up the two biggest bookers in Boston and was reading off of a sheet of places that I had never played in New York and said that I had played at these places. Please come and take a look at me. And they gave me auditions, and from that moment on, I was headlining comedy clubs sometimes 4, 5, 6, 7 nights a week while I was working as a DA. So... it was there was no plan or no
right.
aspiration when I was a kid to be a stand-up comedian. It's just the way it happened.
That's great. Now, when and how did they find out, the government find out that you were doing comedy? And did you ever face one of those, you know,
the way you say
it,
the government, it sounds like the NSA now. Like, how did they discover?
The state.
You know, were they listening in your conversation? You know what? The honest to God truth is my last name is Murphy, even though I was brought up in an Italian household with my Italian grandparents, my uncle Vito, who my mother all spoke Italian. Everything in my life was Italian except for my last name. So my friends in college used to call me Angelo. And before I went on stage the first time, I said, I better use a different name because I don't know if they'll allow me to do this in the DA's office.
Right.
And so I said, I'll be Paul D'Angelo. A variation of what they used to call me in college. So I did that. And the first night I went up, they called out Paul Murphy to the stage, and I started to walk up. My friend said, "What? I thought you gave him a different name." I said, "They must have made a mistake." And 400-pound guy waddled up to the stage named Paul Murphy, and he was horrible. My friend, his only laugh he got is when he physically lifted up his stomach and said, "How you like my new belt buckle?" And my friends were peeing their pants. They're going, "I can't believe they're going to think this guy is you." I said, "I better keep that name straight." And then after I started headlining the clubs, there were a couple times where people came over to me and said, "I overheard a conversation at the next table, and I heard the guy say, that looks like the guy who sent me to prison. But that guy was Irish, and this guy's Italian, so it can't be the same guy." So I said, "I better keep the two names separate."
That's interesting.
And then when I moved to L.A., I tried to go back to my real name. They already were familiar with me under my pseudonym and just stuck.
Now, do you still have an active bar license? Do you ever take any clients, or are you completely done?
You know what? Once in a while, I'll go into court, and I put on a necktie. It feels like a noose around my neck, and I walk into the courthouse, and I go, "What are you doing here?" I said, "I don't know. I just have to remind myself how lucky I am to do comedy every night." It's like being an alcoholic. I got to go to Lawyers Anonymous meetings, and sometimes I drive by a courthouse. I get the shakes. I said, maybe I'll take one case, but then, you know, the next thing you know, you're taking two cases, three cases, you're working nights, weekends, and you're a lawyer again. So,
right.
Yeah.
Now, and you know, things are a little different. You said, and you were pretty lucky, you sort of skipped that in-between period, you know, trying to make it, and you were skilled enough and in the right place to be able to take that next step. Like, just myself, I'm still working up to be at a level where you're at, and I'm still practicing law. And sometimes I try to keep it pretty separate, but when other comics find out that I have a, quote, legitimate day job, I think they see or treat me a little bit differently. Did you ever notice that comics treated you differently when they found out that you were a criminal attorney or a prosecutor?
Well, is that redundant, criminal attorney?
Right, exactly.
But when you say treat you differently, how do they treat you differently?
There just seems to be sometimes a separation between, one, the people who, you know, don't have any other job but comedy, and so they're really, really dependent upon the comedy working out, or just the fact that I can't stay out till, you know, 2 a.m. hanging out at the comedy store because I have a 7 a.m., you know, conference call or filing due, things like that.
Well, the reason I asked you is because I was going to say some comedians probably would respect you. Wow, that's impressive that you do that as well. And others might say, "Wow, you're not taking this seriously because you have another job."
Right.
Be honest with you, when I have some routines I've written about being an attorney, and there was a long time I never even mentioned it, and I don't typically mention it in my introduction unless it's a group associated with law enforcement or something, which I do a lot of big conventions and things like that. But people say, "Why don't you talk about being an attorney? Because that's impressive." And I said, I had the opposite feeling. I said, you know what, when I tell people on stage at the beginning of my career that I was an attorney, I felt like all my parents were in the audience, and they all look at me going, "What the hell are you doing?
Doing, yes."
And I was almost embarrassed, like I was almost ashamed to admit, like, well, because I'd say, well, maybe people look at me and go, well, he can't be a very good attorney if he's doing this.
Right.
Which wasn't true. So I kind of shied away from it a little. As far as the comedians, yeah, I think they respected me for that, especially all the ones that I represented when they
needed help.
There was no shortage of business that way. I think they see it in my presentation and my writing. I mean, I did so many trials, and what a great training to mm-hmm. do trials, because you know, a judge admonishes you in front of a full courtroom and a jury, and no heckler can bother you after that, after you've been humiliated by a judge.
Right, on the record. Courtroom.
And they see, I think, my comedy is, my bottom line is make it funny. Make it funny, make people laugh out loud, whatever. But there's intelligence in my humor. So that all comes from writing skills. I clerked for judges in the probate court for a while, had to do a lot of writing there and stuff. And there's a lot of skills that, you know, they translate into the comedy world. So I think they could see that in my presentation too. So I think they respect it.
That's great. That's great. And now I know you've done a lot of traveling. Do you have a favorite club or venue to perform at?
Well, honestly, you know, it's not the club business that it used to be. Just for an example, I had my own show at the best club in Boston, which was Nick's Comedy Stop, in the theater district. In those days, for 8 years, I had that show. I mean, there were 300 or 400 people every night, and that was open 7 nights a week, and there were 2 shows on Friday night, sometimes 4 or 5 even on a Saturday night. And that club now is just, you know, it's just a Friday, Saturday night, 1 show a night club and stuff. So a lot of the clubs are like that. If they didn't close, they have a limited schedule and everything like that. So
right.
I'm busy most every night, but a lot of it is corporate shows, conventions, fundraisers, benefits, private events, things like that. So you know, it's the travel now. When I travel now, there's a lot of clubs that ask me to go to the clubs. But you know, you get a little bit older. I don't want to spend the whole week in a hotel room waiting for that 45 minutes every night. So I fly out for corporate shows, and I'll go all over the country doing conventions and things like that. But I'm so busy around New England and Northeast, actually, so you know, New York, New England, Pennsylvania, everything like that. I'm not traveling quite as much as I used to, but I'm busier than ever.
Great, great. And just for our listeners, I know, Paul, that you have released 3 DVDs or CDs in just the last year or two, and our listeners can purchase those on your website or on Amazon. And there's also some great clips on Paul's website. I watched the Women Love Cats clip, and I was laughing hysterically.
Well, yeah, I have 3 great quality CDs. They're all different. They're all 50-minute plus CDs that are all different. I'm pretty prolific writing, and I did a DVD, which people have really liked the DVD, which 2/3 of that is different than the CDs too, and they really like it because I'm pretty animated on stage.
Mm-hmm.
I act out a lot of things. A lot of it's facial expressions and acting it out. I'm not one of those people who just stands at a microphone, so they love the DVD. In fact, I'm thinking of doing another DVD this year. But they can get them all on my website, and they've been playing them a lot on Sirius Radio, and so it's been going very well, and they've been really well received.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for speaking with us. To wrap up, do you have any advice that you can share with either young lawyers or young comics?
Mama, don't let your baby grow up to be lawyers. I don't know. I don't. Lawyers. I'll tell you, lawyers. No matter what you do with your law degree, I would say that the skills that you learn from law school, from being an attorney, can translate into anything. They'll help you in any other field. And just because you have a law degree, don't limit yourself to that, because there are a lot of other ways that you could succeed using those skills. And it's never too late to change. I started doing comedy when I was 30, 31, and it's never too late to change. And I thank God. I'm just so lucky that I do something that I love to do, and I'm very fortunate. As far as comedians are concerned, you know what? To be a good comedian, it takes hard work. You have to start off with some type of skill, whether it's a personality, a character, a look, something like that. And you have to have some kind of sense of timing or sense of humor or whatever. But after that, it really takes a lot of work. I try to help out a lot of newer comedians, and every one of them says, I never realized how hard you work at this. And they'd write a joke, and I say, what do you think of that? They say, I think it's a good joke. I said, why don't you want it to be a great joke?
Right.
And they said, I never thought of that. I said, well, you know what? Keep working it. Keep working until it's a great joke. And it's like anything. Anybody that makes anything look easy means that they put a lot of time and effort into it and really worked hard at it. And there's no substitution, to be honest.
I think that's great advice on both parts. And again, to our listeners, check out Paul's website, which is pdangelo.com. And Paul, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you for letting me speak to you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it was fantastic. Take care.
Okay, take
Bye-bye.
care. Thank you.
Fascinating. We had to get that guy. That was a great interview. We have to get that guy on a show up north.
Yeah, we definitely do. We absolutely do. He's really well regarded. I've talked to a lot of comics out of Boston. They all speak very, very highly of him.
Oh yeah, the Boston comedy scene loves Paul D'Angelo.
They do indeed.
Should we hit up the Twitter feed?
Yeah, I'm going to it right now.
We had a pretty solid week on Twitter.
Well, as always, we are getting a lot of followers week to week. I mean, our followers are growing because we've been smart enough not to tweet about topics like Justine Sacco. so that's
good.
Yeah,
we're being cautious with our tweets. We're being funny, but not not offensive. That's where we try to play in that world.
Right. So in the last 10 days, it looks like we've got 5, 10, 12, I think it looks like 17 new followers, which is fantastic.
You want to give them a quick shout out? Can you do a little rundown?
All 17? The last 5 or 6.
Yeah.
How about that? So we've got Riaz Samnani and Haley Sherman, Tushar Singh, Colin Clark. Oh, Colin Clardy. That's the interesting one because this guy is a person who played in the NFL as a tight end.
I think he plays in the NFL.
He might still be in. We're trying to look track that down to see if he's still on an active roster.
So this is our first professional athlete following us.
I believe that's true. So we got to really find out what Colin Clardy's doing.
Wait, does Anna Kournikova not still play tennis?
Is she following us too?
No.
Okay. So Colin's the guy we got to track down because that'd be a huge get for us to get him on the show as one of our followers.
Yes.
And then we also wanted to give a special shout out to Mr. Bernard. Who sent us the hashtag CalPod, one of the few people who's ever used it.
We were talking offline, he's one of our super fans. We should send him a holiday gift.
Yeah, we're definitely going to send him a gift, which would be a picture of Kevin flexing while wearing a Comedians Alive t-shirt.
If that's what he wants, I doubt he would want that.
No. Maybe we can get the ladies of Comedians Alive to post
calendar,
or something. But
the calendar, the ladies,
the count, the ladies of Comedians Alive. No, we'll send Mr. Bernard another t-shirt. We'll work something out with him.
Yeah.
Because he's been a real super fan and has been
keeping
up.
Yeah, we appreciate that. We appreciate the engagement from all our fans. I think that wraps it up this week.
Absolutely, man.
All right, well, we will talk to you for our last podcast of the year next week. And, we wish you all a happy holidays. Make sure to buy people good gifts.
Yes.
Yeah. All right, take it easy. That's episode 65. Matt Ritter and Alex Barnett signing off.